Welcome to Self-Compassionate Professor, a career wellness podcast for mid-career and recovering academics who want more. More meaning, balance, rest, joy, and more clarity. Our motto here is no regrets. So glad you're here. Hello, hello, hello. How are you? I have to admit that I am tired. I have been working too hard. I have been working too much. And my husband said to me, "You preach this career wellness stuff, and it's time to practice what you preach." And so I have decided to take it a little bit easy. And I went ahead and reached out to Dr. Rebecca Schisler Marshall, who I interviewed in episode 22. And I asked her if she would be willing to let me re-release her episode. I know there are a lot of people who have not heard her episode because I didn't have nearly as big of an audience back then. So this will be new to most of you. And I just didn't want to put in the work to do a whole new episode. I needed time. I needed space. I needed a break. And I chose Rebecca's episode to re-release because we talk a whole lot about self-care and self-compassion. And in this interview, she actually says toward the end, you know, if you have self-compassion, everything else wellness-wise will fall into place. And so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to practice self-compassion and take it easy for the next few days because I need it. And then the other thing that I thought was really funny and sort of serendipitous was that Rebecca had said to me when I reached out and said, "Hey, would you mind if I re-released your episode?" She said to me, "You know, I have shut everything down for the month." She's like, "I am going into deep, deep rest." And one of the things I know about Rebecca, and you'll find out in this episode if you haven't heard it already, it's that she's super, super, super good at self-care. Like, this is what she does very, very well. And she knew she needed deep rest, and here she is taking the month to really give that to herself. And I gotta say, I am inspired. And I think after hearing what she is doing in terms of taking the month off, I am going to do the same thing. I'm gonna take a month off because I just need it, plain and simple, right? And the other thing that I was thinking about too is I just saw on LinkedIn my colleague, Dr. Sean Mark Anderson, an organizational communication professor at Loyola Marymount University, and also the founder of his own consulting business. But this is what he said on LinkedIn that just kind of hit me hard. And that was, "Time is money," was an old adage that I always heard, but never understood until I started making money. "Nowadays, time to me is much more. Time is energy. Time is rest. Time is self-care. Time is saying no, time is saying yes. No matter your work-life balance, be sure that your time gives you joy." And in this frenzied, overworked state I've been in recently, those words landed hard. I know for certain my self-care has fallen to the wayside. I went a month without sugar, and then I just started to lose it because I had been overworking myself, and I didn't have the capacity to keep it together anymore. I didn't have the capacity to take care of myself anymore in that way. But I also, you know, stopped eating vegetables, right? The only thing I had time for were potato chips and granola bars. I also quit exercising and journaling, right? Like, there is this sort of initial sign that I'm starting to go off the rails. And the sign is usually that I'm too much in my head. I'm not making enough sort of rest time for myself at night. Like, I'm overthinking. I'm sort of overworking in my head, even though I'm not actually technically working, right? I'll be in the shower trying to like plan things out. And for me, that's usually the first sign that I'm on a bad path. And I loved that when I finally took a step back and said, "Hey, Rebecca, would you let me re-release your episode?" The first thing she said to me was, "I'm glad you're resting." And I guess this is why it's easier for me to rest and to take care of myself now than it was in the past, because I am surrounded by people who believe that it's important. I have a social network that supports that. And here it is, November, right? Nearing the end of the semester. And I know many of you are drained. Like, you don't even know who you are anymore, right? Like, wait, what's my name again? What do I like? Do I care about anything? Because you probably feel so careless about everything. If you are in this place, let me just say to you, consider taking a break. And if you do take a break, if you take that bold step and take a break, right? Brené Brown talks about the courage to take a break in our society being sort of a mammoth task. And so if in this place of stress, in this place where you feel like you've lost yourself, if you decide to take the break, I guess I want to say to you what Rebecca said to me, which is, I'm glad you're resting. So in the spirit of wellness, I present to you Dr. Rebecca Schisler Marshall, integrative wellness expert and associate professor. Check out her awesome podcast called Centered Living. And at the end of this interview, if you feel compelled to work with her, which I don't know why you wouldn't, she's amazing, you can check out her website called centeredyou.com. That's centeredyou.com. All right, here she is now.
All right. Hi, Rebecca Schisler Marshall.
Hello. I'm so glad to be
here. It's so good to talk to you. Yay. we have these fun little intermittent conversations from time to time. And the first time was 2 years ago when I was like at a breaking point and I was like, I cannot be an academic anymore and I need help and I need somebody who's also trying to do this academic stuff, but also other things. And so we talked then, and you were very much a guide then. And then, gosh, we talked about a year ago, and you were guiding me at that time, too, in terms of thinking through what it looks like and to be a vegan, because that's something that's weighed on you for a lot. And so I just want to say, first off, thank you.
Aww. You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
I have absolutely appreciated our conversations, even though they only happen once a year. We at least are connected on social media, so I do know what's going on a bit with you. Yeah. So I will start by just saying that Dr. Marshall is an integrative wellness expert, educator, and researcher. She is the founder of Centered Living and an associate professor at the University of Georgia. And so this podcast is really about people creating from like a very traditional academic path, something that works for them in a creative way, in a self-compassionate way. And you seem to be doing that. So right now you're doing a lot of different things. How are you making it work?
Well, first I just want to thank you for offering something like this for people, because if I would have had access to this during my academic career, right? Like at the beginning, because you know, in academia it's like you will do this or you will leave. Like the you know, and there's no like, or you could take academia in this way, or you could take your PhD and do this, or there's no, you know, other, or there were very few when I started 20 some odd years ago in academia. So thank you for offering this to the world.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, right. So I'll talk a little bit about kind of what I used to do a little bit, if that's okay. And maybe that will give a little context since, you know, I started 20 years ago and, you know, I was so young. I was 26 when I got my PhD and didn't, you know, it was just kind of like one of those, I'm just doing the thing that I'm supposed to do. And I had really hadn't questioned yet. You know, I hadn't gotten to that like, is this really what I want to do kind of a phase? And my background is in speech language pathology and in psychology. And so I was pulling together cognition and how that affects language and looking at attention. And it was, you know, I kept looking for like, but what interests me? How do I do this? You know, the reason I pulled in speech pathology is psychology was kind of like, meh. Like I was doing a lot of working memory stuff and it was like, but what about the people? And so then I pulled in speech pathology and then it was like, I don't want to just do therapy, a speech, you know, speech language therapy. I want to do more. I want to ask questions. I want to, you know, really be thinking deeply about things. And the problem was after tenure, when you know, I kind of came up for air, it was like, oh, I'm pretty miserable. You know, like, surprise, this is not fulfilling me. So even though I had been kind of searching and trying to shift and change and do these things, I was really very achievement and goal-oriented and productive and not asking, you know, what do I want to do or even what makes me happy or what lights me up. And I was very sick because of it. I was physically ill. And that was one of those like, maybe I need to listen, right? Maybe I need to listen to my body a lot more. And I think that's where all of this other, you know, you were saying you do all this other stuff outside of academia, and that's where the integrative wellness expert piece, practitioner came in, is because I really needed to do something for me. I had to take charge, if it were, of my own health, because everyone else was just saying, well, yeah, like if that's just stress, I'm so sorry. good luck. That's what happens when you're working 80 hours a week. And it's like, well, then why am I working that much, right? Why would I do that to myself? Why wouldn't I exercise? Why wouldn't I? So I started just learning about and really, actually, in graduate school, I learned about mindfulness and was sort of using it some, but not to the extent that I really was living it. So that was, you know, more than 20 years ago. So by the time, about 15 or 16 years ago, it was like, no, I really want to understand mindfulness. And I went and trained with Jon Kabat-Zinn and Saki Santarelli for mindfulness-based stress reduction. And that gave me like one of these, you know, aha moments of kind of leading up to that of mindfulness has, even 15 years ago, had a ton of evidence and research of the ways that it could change the body and the mind and the emotions. So I started applying that to my research. I started applying mindfulness to my research. I started pulling it. You know, I was doing it for myself. I noticed differences for myself. I was like, what about in the people I'd worked with individuals who had had a stroke and had language loss? And they are, you know, they're going through so many identity changes on top of the language and the cognition changes that they're having. That I started thinking, well, we know that there's this evidence that mindfulness can change attention. What if we study that? You know, I know attention, so this makes sense. I can pull in my love for mindfulness. And that, it's really funny because I joke with some of my friends in mindfulness that mindfulness is kind of a gateway to all these other possibilities. So I started doing mindfulness, and then I did yoga teacher training, and because it was like, oh, it's not just about mindfulness, it's about moving my body that can activate the parasympathetic nervous system, not just the breath. And so there was, you know, and yoga talks a lot about nutrition, and so I started learning all of these nutritional pieces to it and how that can affect the it can affect epigenetics and how stress can affect epigenetics. And I just started, you know, it was like this beautiful rabbit hole of how they all link together, which led me to life coaching, which led me to Reiki, which led me to, I think all of those kind of led me to shamanism. You know, it was like, I would learn more and it was like, wait, there's this energy, there's this intuition, right? I started learning how to intuitively receive messages from guides. All of that to say, that's kind of where I started. And really it was from my own journey. And then, well, how do I, you know, I was following what I loved and how do I incorporate this to actually help people? And now it's evolved even more to helping not just individuals who have had strokes, people with aphasia, but the students who are at the university. And I started teaching mindfulness there at the university because it's most mainstream acceptable of all of the things that I do.
Right.
And students, you know, it's accessible. Like it's, you can teach a class on it and say, hey, I'm teaching you stress reduction. And the students mm-hmm. will sign up in a heartbeat for it.
Sure.
What I guess I want to ask is, you said the mindfulness stuff was this aha moment for you, and you saw these differences in yourself, and then you just wanted to start integrating it into your research, and then that then took you all these other places that you didn't expect, Reiki and and shamanism and other stuff. And so what I guess I want to ask is, what were the sort of personal changes you noticed? Do you have like a story that could give us a clear idea of what you were seeing in yourself?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I was dealing with, in graduate school, I was dealing with so many health issues. So I had migraines that were pretty relentless and irritable bowel syndrome. I had high blood pressure. So you imagine, you know, someone in their early 20s with, or I'm sorry,
wow.
High cholesterol. And, you know, and the doctor's looking at me going like, this is not good. Like you're skinny and you're in your 20s and your cholesterol is really high.
Wow.
It was, you know, and they were, you
wow.
know, and they were boggled by the migraines. You know, they did CT scans. I found out through all of these processes that I also had polycystic ovarian syndrome. So there were these
wow.
other little things that were happening that once I realized, oh, that's why, you know, my cycle was so irregular. It's why I had acne still. It's why my mm-hmm. mood was so up and down. Was that things hadn't been diagnosed. And when I complained about them, you know, doctors would do the standard test of, you know, what they know, what they've been taught. And then luckily I had a doctor that was at least a little insightful. And she was like, you know, you really need to make sure you're getting enough sleep. And, you know, how much are you getting as a graduate student? And I was like, I don't know, like 6, you know, and I, you know, honey, you can't live off
mm-hmm.
that. Oh, I was also diagnosed with hypoglycemia, and she was saying, maybe you need
Holy
to change
no.
your diet and look at your diet too. So all this was happening in a couple of years. And so when I started doing things like looking at how my diet influences how I feel, things started changing. When I started sitting and meditating, things started
mm-hmm.
changing. And I mean, like, you know, the headaches went away. My migraines went
mm-hmm.
away. My mood became way more balanced. The irritable bowel syndrome shifted. The
wow.
polycystic ovarian syndrome was a longer exploration with food, but some of those symptoms also completely reversed with me changing my diet. And then, you know, I had battled with depression in high school, and everyone was just kind of like, you know, I mean, I didn't really even tell that many people with it. I just was like, okay, yeah, I think about suicide. Isn't that what all teenagers do? And I didn't tell anybody.
Wow.
And that changed as I realized, oh, I have to take care of my body, not just on one level, but on all of these different levels, food, mentally, you know, what's my mind doing? So that the mindfulness was a huge practice for me, my emotions, what's happening emotionally, that's where coaching you know, really came in to help with that as well, and taking care of my physical body. Am I moving my body? Am I doing yoga or walking or running or, you know, all those different pieces? Really started seeing, you know, the holistic picture, this integrative approach to being a healthy, vibrant human. So I'm way healthier wow. now in my 40s than I was in my 20s.
Right. And that's unbelievable. I mean, in our culture, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, it was a reversal that happened, so much so that when I went to doctors that were, I went to a very specific doctor because she was a specialist in polycystic ovarian syndrome. And she was saying, well, I can put you on these drugs. And I was saying, I don't want to be put on drugs. I want to cure the problem. And I said, what about me doing diet to change it? And she was like, whatever, do whatever you want. But if it doesn't work in X number of weeks, then I'm putting you on this medicine. And I came back and said, here, and she did all my tests. And she was like, you're the poster child for nutrition. Like, I can't believe all of your labs have changed. All of your, like, so I had evidence. Not just how I was feeling, but a doctor who was like, you don't need to see me. It was enough for me to be like, oh, there is a better way. I don't have to give away my own power of who I am. I know how I feel, and I don't have to give that away to a doctor. Yes, I still go to doctors. Yes, I still need their input. Mm-hmm. And I can go to them, ask for advice, ask for tests, and that doesn't mean I have to necessarily follow that path. I can bring up other options, other ways of doing things.
How are you integrating this stuff into your teaching? I guess I'm really interested in the teaching part for whatever reason, because my guess is, like most coaches, you've had this thing in your life that was a crisis that you healed, and now you want to teach other people. And so I'm wondering, are you able to integrate it into your university classes, and how does that look and how does that work?
Yeah, well, that's a really great question, actually. And it's funny that you were like, I really want to know about teaching, because if you ask me about research, I could answer that. But it's a little more challenging
right?
with teaching, because in particular in my university, there are in the department I'm in, there are very specific classes that have to be taught. Like, it's not just like, what would you like to teach? It's, we have an accreditation for speech language pathology. They have to have certain classes. And I was the one hired to teach those classes. So there are certain particular classes that I am kind of slated to teach that I need to teach.
Okay.
But what I've done is I incorporate mindfulness into them, which is, as I mentioned, that seems to be very easy because the students are master's level students and they're stressed.
Yeah.
And when I say at the beginning of class, how are you feeling? You know, what's going on for you right now? And so I use the coaching. I use mindfulness at the beginning. Let's take a deep breath together. Can you ground into the earth? And so that would be a little bit of, you know, shamanism and Reiki. Can you feel the breath in your body? That's mindfulness. Can you see what thoughts you're thinking? You know, so the coaching. So I incorporate that 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the beginning of class for some classes. So the other thing I'm doing is I teach a mindfulness. I did kind of lobby to teach a mindfulness for stress reduction class. And so it's a whole 3-hour semester long class, and I incorporate into that some coaching. I haven't felt as comfortable including some of the shamanism, although, you know, again, a little bit around the edges. When they asked for things, there was a student who came in and she was like, I lost my keys and blah, blah, blah. And I'm feeling all this. And so we used a little mindfulness. We used a little like thought work. And then it was like, and why don't you just ask, you know, like, spirit guides to help you find your keys. And she came in the next class and she was like, you are not going to believe this. I found my stinking keys. Like, after you said that, and I had looked for 3 days to find my keys. And so it was, you know, it was like one of those little pieces where it's not in the syllabus, but 37 people were sitting in that class, and maybe they'll use that where they can just say, like, okay, you know what? My brain isn't doing it for me right now. I can ask for the support from the spirit world, which is what shamanism does, right? That we have these spirit guides that are here to guide and protect us and work with us. So that's one of the ways I've brought it in. And the third way is in another class, I actually said, okay, we're doing communication coaching. And I brought in a module where I teach them how to use mindfulness and some of the coaching methods for communication with people who have aphasia, who have had a stroke and have loss of language, and how to be present for them in their jobs that they're doing. So to apply it in a professional way. So I don't get to do the wellness, all of the wellness. I don't get to do as much nutrition, although I do say, hey, I'm plant-based. And, you know, what we know about stroke is these cardiovascular pieces are, you know, a huge play. And what we know about animal protein is this. And here's what you can do.
At what point are you, if there is a point, is there a point where you want to do more and integrate more, but it's just not going to work in that environment? And what are those pieces that you would like to talk more about in class?
Yeah, that is, again, wonderful question. Yes, because would I like to do more? Hell yeah. Like, can I say that? I would very much like to do more. I have, it's funny, I said I want to do this integrative rehabilitation class for speech-language pathologists where my plan was to talk about more. And I do talk some about nutrition in the mindfulness class. And, you know, that mindfulness class, I really feel like I have the ability to talk about almost all the things that I want to. I feel a little bit less about energy and, you know, I talk about nutrition. I've talked about coaching. I talk about mindfulness. I talk about yoga. I don't talk about shamanism as much or energy as much. And yes, I would love it. I proposed an integrative rehab class and they were like, we just can't afford you to not be teaching these other classes. Like, you could do that on top of your workload if you would like. Right. I don't feel like that is going to give me the satisfaction that I want, because I kind of know I'm really good at self-care and I kind of know my boundaries in terms of how much can I give without getting anything back. And that's one of those places where it's like, no, in my body, that's a firm no. I'm teaching, you know, two each semester, which is enough. That's otherwise I start to get scattered and I can't remember what I said in what class and it's just not good for me. Was there a second part to that question about do I want to do more?
I guess I just wondered if there were really specific pieces that you would love to be able to teach. You would love for your students to have those lessons, but you're just kind of unable to do it because of the way the curriculum is set up at this point.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I would love to teach a class on this, you know, the process that I use with my clients in my business, which is obviously, you know, separate, is the five wellness bodies or the centered wellness framework. And it's just like what we've been talking about. There are these five pieces of us that to be really whole, we need to look at all the pieces and the energy and the spirit. You can't leave those parts out. And it's so much of what we don't talk about in our culture. And we don't talk about spirits very often. Some of us do, but it's not a mainstream thing. Like, we talk about you need to exercise, you need to sleep well, you need to eat good food. That we call kind of no. Some people know more about the mental body. You know, they think about, oh, I need to go to a therapist and what's going on in my mind, right? Or the emotional body. They kind of think of therapy for that and seeing a counselor. But the energy and the spiritual part, that's where shamanism and Reiki and, you know, those sorts of practices, I would really love to be able to teach that to students so that they have a different perspective on wellness. It's not speech language pathology, so it's not something that my department that is like super fired up about. And, you know, I live in the South, which tends to be slightly more conservative. And so talking about shamanism and Reiki, you know, is a little bit more challenging. Although I will say Emory University invited me to come do, they invited me the last 2 years to come do a talk to one of their classes on the evidence in Reiki. And there's a ton of evidence of how it helps physically and emotionally. So there's some really nice scientific work that's done for Reiki that can be incorporated, which is why it's like, yeah, there are these different ways that we can look at health. And I think the medical system is doing it in a very limited way, and that there's this possibility for looking at it differently.
Okay, so we have to talk about this, because there's some stuff you've said, like, oh, you know, I have this student, and I talked to her about her spirit guides, and we talked about her asking for support, and then she's like, oh my gosh, I found him. And then you had said something about like, you know, I'll slip in, you know, intuitively receiving messages from guides. And I'm thinking, how the heck do you do that? So one, you gotta unpack this a little bit for us. Like, what is shamanism? What is Reiki?
Because, you know, in the literature, right, I do the evidence and there's some Reiki evidence, and it's become a lot more mainstream, whereas I was looking for shamanism in the literature, you know, somewhere, and all I can tend to find it is an anthropological work, right? Because that's what shamanism is the indigenous cultures. And it's kind of like they would call them medicine men or medicine women, because it was more than just spirits, but basically it was the one who works with that which is beyond the veil, right? So the shamanic view is we are on this earth, right? We have these bodies that we can actually touch, and right next to us are spirits. And those spirits are from people who have passed away and have not been, let's see how I can explain this, have not been adequately crossed over to where their spirits are supposed to go, because we lost touch with the roots of what we're supposed to do. And the roots of what we're supposed to do are be in one with nature, to take care of, cultivate these ancestral connections, you know, that we have. We honor our ancestors. We learn how to live well and die well. And to die well, we take care of our own stuff so that either someone crosses us or we can help cross ourselves. We can be ready to leave this, what is called the middle world, this land that we live on is the middle world, and go to either the upper or the lower world. So shamanism thinks there's these three different levels. I have guides. Like, I have a guide that's a Reiki guide. I have guides that are ancestral guides. Like, in shamanism, there are like all these guides that you can have depending on what you do. So you can ask for guides. You can ask for animals. Well, let me say, in shamanism, everyone is said to have a power animal that steps forward and volunteers to be with you for your entire life. Most of us just don't, you know, we aren't told that. So one of the things that a shaman can do is called a power animal retrieval, where you are reconnected with that animal, with that, you know, and it's not like, you know, that little bunny over there, it's the spirit of bunny, you know, the spirit of bear or dolphin, right? All of those animals are here to, again, bring us power and energy. So there's so much, this is kind of like the surface. There's so much to shamanism, and I could talk for the entire time about shamanism because I love it so much. But that you can see
okay.
how that's a little bit harder to chat about, like the dead people that are around that might be blocking you. And, you know, most of us who feel stuck or depressed, it's because we have an energy that needs to be removed. And that's one of the things that shamans do. We'll remove an energy that doesn't belong to you. We'll cut cords where you are attached to people that you shouldn't be attached to that are siphoning your energy off. So from my view, when people come to me and they say there's an illness there or there's a stuckness that they have, I want to see, like, are they eating a bunch of crap? Are they moving their body? Are they sleeping? Are their thoughts, you know, are their thoughts being looked at? Are they in check? You know, are they processing their own emotions? Are they clearing energy that should not be there? You know, when we walk into an airport, we pick up energy. And are they connecting with guides? Are all of their soul essences returned to them? Because often when we go through life, we have some sort of trauma. And when there is trauma, a soul essence will kind of go into hiding until it's safe. So sometimes someone who is sick or stuck, they either need energy cleared or they need a soul essence returned to them or a power animal retrieval because that energetic spiritual component hasn't been tended to.
So you need to then talk about it in a concrete example for those of us that need some more clarity around this.
Yeah, I know. It sounds, it's people are like, what? And I'm like, I know. It's so funny. It seems so practical to me. So people are like,
right?
You could just see steam coming out of their ears. And I'm just like, of course that we have this trouble. So for instance,
yeah,
let's go back
yeah.
to the airport, right? Like we all,
okay.
you know, well, right now we're not really going to airports, but grocery stores. Let's say somebody is stressed out because they're having a tough time with this pandemic. I mean, good Lord, it's not a hard scenario to go to, right? Maybe they're not making as much money or their kids are very loud at home. I'm just saying. And so that person may be, you know, kind of like having all these negative thoughts where they're really struggling, and you walk by them and maybe you're a very open person. You pick up on what other people feel, and you may accidentally, right? It's not like they did it on purpose. It's not like you did it on purpose, but you may accidentally pick up some of that energy. And it's not good or bad. It's just not yours. And so someone who has training in this, so for instance, it's my guides that do this, not me, but I am trained by having my know what guides to go to. My guides will go and clear that energy. And what my clients say is, oh my gosh, I feel like so much better. And nothing changed in my physical environment. Like, you know, it's not like I did anything different, but I'm just no longer carrying around that other person's energy.
So what does that look like for your clients when they come in to see you and you're clearing energy for them? What is that experience like? I mean, I know everybody has a different experience, but generally what could a person expect?
So I do most of my work distance. And so they're, you know, hanging out either on the phone or on Zoom with me, and they're in their own, you know, special space, wherever they want to be, in their bedroom or on the couch or in the woods. Right. And so all I'm asking them to do is to imagine themselves in a place, a real place in nature. So some of my clients will just really feel like there was this beautiful tree I was sitting against, and I was just, you know, I just felt so relaxed and peaceful, and they may not feel anything other than that. Whereas some people are like, I felt this thing coming off of my left leg, and I don't really understand that. And when
oh,
I'm telling
wow.
them, like, I took this thing off of your left leg that, you know, that was there, that was obviously wasn't yours. It was like a black sludge. And they're like, yeah, I could feel that. It really does depend on the person. And some people are, you know, of course, some people will fall asleep because it's either so relaxing, or they'll just feel a little different, like it's a little more subtle. But then they notice they can do things that they weren't able to do before. Like, you know, maybe there's something there's been a lot of resistance to doing, like, I really need to edit that paper, and, or I really need to grade those papers, or, you know, and you know how that is, where we think, oh, it's just procrastination, and then sometimes it's energy, and it's just energy that needs to be removed, and when it's removed, then we can do the thing, or the things that we need to do.
Wow. As you describe this, I think, wow, we really, 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 really need this in our culture so that we can heal more fully. And the
That's
other
what
thing
I think
about.
Yes, yes.
And I also think about that sort of academic circle that says, what is this shamanic crap? What is this appropriation of indigenous cultures? What do you say to that sort of circle? There's another circle too that's just like, this is crap and there's no research on it and blah blah blah. But then you've got this other one that I used to be a part of, that's very much like, this is not okay to appropriate indigenous cultures. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so what do you say to that group? And when I say blah, 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 I guess I should be more respectful to the position from which they speak. But yeah, there is something that you need to say to them, I think.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really great point. And yes, I mean, there's a reason why I don't call myself a shaman. I call myself an integrative wellness, you know, expert or practitioner, or a shamanic practitioner, if I say that as well. I learned shamanism, and you know who I learned from was an anthropologist who went to the cultures and learned this. And he trained, you know, I learned from Sandra Ingerman, who learned from Michael Harner, who is the anthropologist, right? So there's this.
Okay.
The idea is that there's nobody that I'm going to ever be able to please with this, because I can't please all the people. Because
I know.
In some
I know.
Ways, I totally get it. Yep, you're right. I am a white person. I am, you know, did not come from the lineage. What I can say is, with as much respect, I bring as much respect as I can to this lineage of, I honor these traditions and these cultures. I honor the spirits. So I do struggle with it. It's like, I don't want to appropriate. And, you know, my spirit guides keep nudging me in this direction. So I feel like I've been called to this work. And so I try to do it with as much respect as I can, you know, including supporting financially, donating to indigenous groups and shamanic groups that are around, because if it weren't for them, I wouldn't have this particular training. So I think that, you know, you can kind of tell that I don't really have any answer for this, except I know that I love it. I know this is who I am. If you believe in past lives, you know, I feel like there is something in me that is linked to this. It's not a genetic link. I'm Caucasian all the way back. And yet this is, it's the work that I'm supposed to do. And I feel like part of my job is to bring it back into culture, because it's been lost.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, part of that is, how can we have the original people bring it back and not just someone who happens to be white bring it back?
Okay. And the thing, too, is that it's not a specific culture, right? It's not like you're going in and saying, yeah, this particular indigenous culture, I'm putting, you know, I'm putting on the same kind of dress as them, and speaking the words that they are, and I'm like, this is like, there's this theme across indigenous cultures, and they all have this sort of similar belief around this particular thing, and you're practicing that sort of generalized version, right? It's not the specific, yes, I'm being this culture.
Yeah, yeah. Michael Harner pulled together what's called core shamanism, which is he looked at all of these different cultures and said, what do they all do? What's similar? Mm. How do they, you know, are there similarities in terms of their practices for journeying and for speaking to spirits? And it's also, if you look at some of the history, it's a practice of what's called direct revelation. So it's actually not supposed to be like, you learn this and then you do this. It's like the question that my teachers always, when I would say, well, how do you do this? They say, well, what do your guides say? I was taught not to go, you know, to look to the spirits for help, because that's who's leading this show, is the spirits, not me, not, you know, a particular white woman who's teaching me, but that's that piece of it. And I know that that could go south too, because I've heard people who are like, well, spirit told me to, and, you know, and then they do all sorts of horrendous things. And, you know, like, I think there's a fine line in lots of different ways, in the same way of God told me to, or, you know, anyway, that could be a whole other rabbit hole to go down. But the idea is, my intention is to honor these traditions as much as I can. I don't wear particular regalia. I wear my, you know, I've got on a t-shirt and shorts. I don't dress a particular way. If my guides tell me I'm supposed to have something, in the same way with yoga, yoga has been appropriated by the West. Guru in yoga was from India, and I follow what he said, you know, in that realm, because he wanted to bring yoga to the West. He wanted white people to do yoga in a way that honored the lineage and the tradition and the teachings of yoga. And so that's what I try to do, is honor those teachings of all of mindfulness, you know, comes from Buddhism. Yoga, you know, that whole yoga has a huge yogic tradition, that also is in the Hindu tradition, and, you know, and then shamanism, all of those, I feel like I'm really, and you're right, it's a constant work in progress of how do I honor this without appropriating.
And what's funny though is, as I hear you, I think, where would I be if I didn't have this stuff? If I didn't have yoga, I would not be able to walk, because my back would be so messed up. If I didn't have mindfulness, because you know, I've done a lot of mindfulness training too, and I've done, you know, mindful self-compassion teacher training, and like, if I didn't have that, I would be an anxious wreck, because I used to be. And I'm thinking about like the things that our culture in the West is completely 100% missing, and we need this stuff. So in my opinion, and what I think about is, you know, we need to be more open to it. And I get some of the arguments around cultural appropriation. But I also think that it's those traditions, it's those knowledge systems that are going to save us from ourselves because we can't keep going down this Western path. We can't.
That's what I see, is that there's a reason those have been around thousands of years, and it's because they work. They work, and what's happened is there's now scientific evidence to prove it, right? There's scientific evidence for yoga. There's scientific evidence for Reiki. There's so many boatloads of scientific evidence for mindfulness and for self-compassion. Kristen Neff's work and self-compassion is beautiful. And, you know, so there's this nutrition, right? Even nutrition, all of that, there's evidence for how we can be living, and you can take it out of that and make it not part of the tradition. And I think you lose something by doing that. When I see Western yoga studios who don't have the, you know, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras as part of it, you're missing the core teachings of yoga. And I feel like it's great for the back, and yoga is a system, right? And physical asana is just one part of it.
And I know we're about out of time, but I want to ask you about what you just said in terms of yoga. So tell me about what a mainstream studio looks like.
I don't want to offend anybody.
The yoga studio.
I know.
It's a hard line to walk. It is.
It's a hard line. But what I see is that a lot of yoga studios are about exercise. It's an exercise studio. And it's just a different kind of exercise. And I think yoga asana is beautiful. There's nothing wrong with doing yoga asana by itself. In one sense, I mean, I think it's fine. It's totally fine. And I think it's not as rich and complex when we look at the possibilities of what yoga says and how yoga approaches it. You know, when we look at, the idea of one of the principles in the Yoga Sutras is Ishwari Pranayama, which is complete and total surrender to Ishwara, a god. Right? That's one of the things, like, at the very end, there's all these, if you're suffering, try this, or try this, or try this. And then at the very end, it's like, or you just totally surrender to God and just do this one thing, and your suffering will decrease. And if we are sitting there on the mat going, I can't get this pose right, and you're beating yourself up on the mat about a yoga pose, or you leave the yoga mat and you go back to your life in the same way, you're missing out on this nourishment that can come from, like, oh, I'm really struggling. Well, I'm going to do what the Yoga Sutras talked about, is I'm just going to have complete and total surrender to God and see what's going to happen next.
And that's essentially your career story. As I listen, right, it's just complete and surrender to what needs to come out of you, and you feel it. And even though this sort of shamanic stuff is like, it probably would have been crazy to that grad student who was super sick, and she probably would have been like, what are you even doing? This is insane. Am I right about that? Would she have said that?
Well, you know, I think she loved it, but she didn't really think that that could be part of the career. So, like, oh, yeah, you're going to talk about that at the university?
Yeah.
You know, I remember reading about, like, Edgar Cayce and, like, past life regression, and I was like, oh, my gosh, like, I love this stuff. And I just thought, oh, I just read the books on it. But it's like, no, I love this stuff so much, I have to do this. And every time you're right, in terms of, like, my younger self would have been like, have you lost your mind? You're going to get fired. You're going to get kicked out. You're going to be the laughing stock. And now I'm like, in faculty meetings, they say, introduce yourself, or not faculty meetings, but, you know, whatever kind of meetings are going on. And I'm like, you know, I'm a life coach, a Reiki practitioner, mindfulness instructor.
Do you say that?
Instructor, I do.
Wow.
And I only started in the last year because I was like, I give up.
The quote that I asked you, I was like, hey, what's your favorite saying? And you said, be kinder to yourself than you think you should be. And this comes from Sherry Huber, who's a Zen monk.
Yeah.
Is that how you say it?
Okay. Yeah, Sherry Huber, who has the monastery, the Zen monastery for peace practice, or living compassion is the other program that she has.
Mm.
She's an amazing monk and guide, spiritual guide, and I highly recommend, if anyone is interested in an awareness practice, to follow her, because she has, you know, 20, 30 years of amazing how to apply mindfulness or awareness practice to real life out there, and it's so good. But yeah, that quote is I have it on my door at my office because I think that's what it boils down to for my students, right? Like when they're like, I'm struggling with this, I'm like, well, how can you be kinder to yourself? Maybe enact this kindness right now. Maybe saying, I'm not going to get this master's degree because it's, I, you know, I'm going to take a year off because my family is struggling financially. What is the kindest thing that you can do for yourself right now?
Oh my gosh. Amen. Amen. And that has just been my work too. Yes.
Right.
Once I started learning how to be kind to myself, it was absolutely life-changing, and I still struggle, but man, I have some tools that I used to never have. And, I can finally breathe.
Yes. That's what's missing, right? With our student. And I think that's part of why I keep staying at the university. It's like, okay, there were 37 more students in that class who learned about self-compassion. Maybe, just maybe, when they're 25, 35, they're going to still have that practice. And maybe 25, 35, you know, students at a time, you know, and then there were another 25 in my master's class. So maybe those 50 students can go out into the world and have a little bit more ease in their own lives. And maybe they'll tell somebody, or maybe they'll teach their children, or maybe with their clients. And so I just keep coming back to, maybe this is the way to spread that, really, I mean, what you point out, that self-compassion, if we can get that, almost all the other stuff falls into place.
Right. So good. So good. Okay. We are out of time. What a beautiful conversation, though. So appreciate it. That changed me a bit. I can definitely feel that. So thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad. It's such a joy to talk to you. This work is so, it's so needed in the world. So thank you for putting it out there.
Oh, thank you for putting your work out there as well. All right. Take care, Rebecca. It was so good talking to you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Self-Compassionate Professor. Find me on LinkedIn at Danielle Delamar, on Twitter and Instagram at Danielle SC Prof, or schedule a free coaching consult at selfcompassionateprofessor.com. Be well.